Welcome to the StarNet Regions 1 and 3 podcast. Illinois StarNet envisions a future where early childhood professionals and families have the supports needed to provide all children with a high-quality, equitable education in inclusive environments. StarNet's mission is to promote evidence-based inclusive practices for young children with disabilities, professional development to support educators and families, meaningful child outcomes through innovative and engaging learning experiences. To find out more about StarNet Regions 1 and 3, please visit starnet.org/home.
So my name is Cecilia Mintz, and I'm here today with Bridget Meese and Katie Madigan from Urbana Early Childhood School. We're going to talk about all things screening and IEP-related, referral process-related. So Katie, can you introduce yourself? Tell us a little bit about you and your experiences in early childhood special ed.
Sure. My name is Katie Madigan. Like Cecilia mentioned, I am currently, my position is assistant principal of the early childhood school in Urbana. And then I'm also an elementary special ed facilitator, which is a fancy word for special ed administrator. So I support some of the other some of the other elementary schools in our district and their special education needs. I also oversee speech language pathologists, OT, PT, and vision and hearing. I come from I was trying to count this morning. I think this is my 20th year in education, all in special ed. I started as a speech language pathologist. I did that for 16 years, and then I've been 4 years as an administrator in this building. So my first 5 years were in a K-5 building as an SLP, but then I moved to early childhood because I really wanted to have that experience. And so I've been in early childhood since 2009, and it's my first love in education, and I hope to never leave it because I just adore 3-, 4-, and 5-year-olds.
Don't we all? They're amazing little creatures. Okay, so let's just start, kind of walk us through your program's screening process, what that looks like, and then how do you identify children who may have a disability that have not been identified previously before coming to the school for screening?
Sure. So I guess I'll start at the beginning. So in usually early August, late July, depending on when our office reopens for the school year, we host big screening events for a week or 2 weeks, where we've got several teams of educators screening students throughout the day prior to school starting, because we want to make sure that we have our classes as full as possible. We know that in the spring before, we will have lost a bunch of students to kindergarten because they age out of our program. And so we do a lot of screening at one time. However, we also then continue to screen 2 days a week throughout the entire school year. And so during that time, we will have somebody that's called our family coordinator, or if they're not available, a social worker, does a parent interview with the family while a teacher is doing the screening instrument, playing with the child. In the same room, we have a large enough space that we can do that, so they can kind of see what's happening. And then after the teacher is finished doing the screening, they'll do kind of like an exit interview to talk about what they found in the screening results. So this is something, I mean, this happens in the summer. This happens in the 2 days a week. We have budgeted so that we are able to have a sub, a floater sub for our teachers that need to be pulled out of the classroom to do the screening, because we found it was important, not only for compliance reasons, but because we wanted teachers to really meet the students and be the expert in the background and educational pre-academics that we're looking at in the screening. So we want the teachers to be involved. Something else that might happen is if a a parent calls in, a family member calls in to make their screening appointment, we have a whole referral sheet that our admin assistants ask questions. And one of those questions is, do you have concerns about your child's development? And at that point, if a parent or family member does indicate that they have a concern, they'll circle that on our referral sheet, and then they'll go ahead and talk to one of the professionals that might have expertise in that area. And they would invite them to that screening so that they can just be another ear for that area of concern, just in that expertise area.
Can you tell us a little bit about like your program's makeup? Because everybody listening to this podcast comes from a wide area of Illinois, hopefully. You know, every program is different and has different funding options, different staffing options. So just kind of walk us through what your program looks like overall, your size, diversity, all of that good stuff.
Sure. So I can't pull the numbers like right out of my head. And they change every day, really. But we have the capacity to serve 360 students here when we're completely full. So we have 12 classroom teachers, and our classroom teachers are all, every single one of them, dually certified in early childhood with a special ed endorsement. And then a few of them also have an ESL endorsement. We'd like all of them to have that, but you know, things happen.
And everybody else.
Yeah.
That is the unicorn everybody wants right now.
Yes, exactly. We're so happy when we can find someone with all of those qualifications, but our minimum criteria for hiring is the early childhood with the special ed endorsement, because we are a fully inclusive program. We have no self-contained special ed classrooms in this building. We haven't since, I think, 1991. So inclusion has always been one of the cornerstones of this program. We have a really diverse community because we're a university town. So we have diversity in income status. Urbana School District in general is 70% low income. We have diversity in language. The last time I counted, which was a while ago, I think we had 25 different languages spoken in this building by family members, but that could be changed now. We have two classrooms that are 98% Spanish. There's teachers and their teaching assistants, all are Spanish speakers, and all the students can speak Spanish, or like when they go to see the librarian who doesn't speak Spanish. Let's see what else. We do have a larger French population, French Congolese population in Urbana. And so we have a classroom with two teaching assistants who are French speakers. Unfortunately, we don't have a teacher that's French speaking right now, but we support those students with those teaching assistants that can know their home languages. So yeah, we have quite a diverse population, always changing, but it makes it really fun.
Well, and with that diverse population, you've got a nice setup then for being able to meet the needs of the children and being able to observe that screening process within the child's home language as well, since you have so many staff that speak the languages that you have present in your program, which is an anomaly, really. Not many programs have that. And so what a wonderful opportunity for the children and families that you're serving.
Yeah. And when we're looking at hiring, we're always hoping to grow that diversity in our staff. And that's just something that we're always keeping in the back of our mind. It's one of our interview questions, is about what kind of special skills you can bring to the table and how you put them to use in a classroom. And we do use all of those people and their special talents and skills.
All right. So we kind of covered that you screen throughout the year and what that screening process looks like. Can you walk us through what it looks like from screening to referral for an IEP?
Sure. So I don't know if I mentioned the screening tools that we use. I'll just say what those are. I know everyone has different ones that they use, but we use the early inventory for preschool, or the ESI. And recently, we started using the Clinical Evaluation of Language Fundamentals Preschool Screening Test, We were previously using an expressive one-word vocabulary test as a screener, but my speech-language pathologist came to me and just felt like that was appropriate use of that assessment. And so they found a better one that they liked more and that they felt gave better information about language usage. And then we also have the families fill out the ages and stages questionnaire, social emotional, before they come in for their screening. And if they are a student that indicates there's another language in the home, then they're given the pre-IPT to test for English proficiency. So those are all the assessments we use. And with those screening tools or assessments, there are cutoff scores. So the ASQ has a monitor and a concern range. And so when we finish all of the screening procedure, we'll look at that, score everything and say, okay, is there something that we need to be concerned about or the family's concerned about with social emotional functioning? The ESI also has three cutoffs. They have okay, monitor and refer, or rescreen and refer, sorry. And so we'll mark that on our lists of when we are placing the students. The self preschool screener also has a criterion score. So we can say, oh, did they meet criteria? We're not concerned about their speech and language skills or not. And so all of that information, when we decide, yes, this child is eligible or not eligible for our program, we allow them to enroll. And I, myself or the other administrators, we look at the information and we are like, okay, there's a student that has ESI refer, ASQ concern, and speech concerns. Wow, that's a lot of concern that showed up in the screening. We might have information from the family, from the parent interview about other concerns that they have, or it's reinforced some of the things that we found in the screening. And so we'll look at that and think about our classroom makeup as it exists at the moment and really find, like, okay, if this teacher already has two students with one with developmental delay and one who's diagnosed with autism in their class, maybe that isn't the best spot for this child to go. And so I'll look at all of the other classrooms. And I do have the ability to look at 11 other classrooms if the first one I think about doesn't fit. So, I mean, that's something that we're lucky to have here. And then I just try to mix and see, like, well, do they have some language models in their classroom or some students that will be social emotional models? Do they have a mixture of students that are new through, but also some that might be going to kindergarten the next year? And so trying to compile that classroom makeup to be as diverse as possible and not put all the students that might have ASQ concerns in one class and all the students that have score on the ESI in this class. So trying to kind of balance that over the 12 classrooms and AM and PM. So really 24 sessions that I have the ability to spread these students out.
So it sounds like you're very intentional with where you're placing the children, even after they've gone through that screening and referral process. And once they have that IEP, so that they have the most success and the teachers are able to spend the time and be able to actually focus on all of the students' needs instead of being overwhelmed with everything. And we know that there's a lot going on anyway. So what does the MTSS process look like for special education students? Because we know that the teachers are going to refer students throughout the year based on what they're seeing in the classroom. How do you avoid that over-referral process?
Okay, so that's a really great question because I think even in my... How long have I been here? 7 years in this building. That process has evolved over time. In the past, when I first started here, there was a lot of just kind of, oh, this is how I feel about this child. And there wasn't necessarily the focus on systems and data around how they're performing. It was just like a feeling. Like, I feel like this kid has more needs than we're
addressing right now. And so thankfully, we had a past administrator who was really adept at creating systems. And so over a couple of years, we really looked at this and worked hard at creating our own version of MTSS here. And so it's been working, I think, I hope. But we also know that we're seeing a lot more kids with a lot more needs than we ever have before. So I'm not sure if over referral is or isn't happening right now, just because of the needs of the students that are coming in. So in our MTSS system, we have really thought intentionally about what is our tier one instruction. And we have things like we follow creative curriculum here. We use the zones of regulation. We supplement our phonemic awareness instruction with Hagerty. We use lots of oral language literacy instruction because we know that that's one of the building blocks of reading. We have classroom calming spaces. We have a PBIS system and we use Second Step. We've got a focus on nurturing and responsive relationships so that we're supporting children through play, they're learning through play, that it's a kind and welcoming environment, high quality supportive classroom. We have classroom visuals all over and alternative seating. So those are just kind of like some examples of our tier one. When we're talking about moving students into additional tiers of instruction, we're really thinking about one, how they enter with their screening results, and then two, how they perform once they adjust to being in a classroom. And so we ask that our teachers don't make any referrals or raise any red flags for the first 30 school days that a student attends, because we want to give children an opportunity to acclimate to their environment. Most of them have never been in school before, and this is a lot more structured than their home or maybe a daycare setting might be. So we want to give them that time. If after those 30 days, they are still really concerned about a student, they might take that screening tool that we have given them when they entered and do a rescreen. So they'll either ask someone to help, maybe our instructional coach or one of our therapists might help and do a rescreen of any of those tools that we used for the initial screening. If those things come up as a concern again, we might initiate some more intensive targeted instruction for that student. And when we're talking about that, we're doing like small groups of specific skill building. We have something our social workers do is a social academic instructional group, which focuses on like learning how to get along with friends, how to follow classroom routine. So they have a small group of students that they'll work out with that. They might do something called check in, check out, where they have to check in after every activity of the day to see how that went. So those would be some of our like tier two instructions. They're not super intensive, but they are something that's a little bit more specialized. And then if we have that 8 to 12 weeks of time that they're receiving those additional instruction and we're still not seeing improvements in any of those deficit areas, then we would move to like a really intensive intervention that's like hyper-focused on one or two skills. And so that would be more individualized.
Yeah, I was wondering about the waiting process, because I know as children settle, as they get used to the routine, that sometimes we see an increase in behavior, but it'll fall off. So it's good to hear that you have a waiting process. I know program I came from, it was 45 days. So similar time to wait. So,
right.
Okay. So that kind of goes along with as children are coming in and getting settled during the school year, and educators have more of a chance to get to know them and they're getting more comfortable and observe them in a natural setting. How do they go through identifying children that may need additional support then.
Yeah, so when they're working through these tiers, we also have a team that meets biweekly to talk about students that are moving through some of these processes. And we've instituted something called support coordinators. So they wouldn't be like a case manager for a student with an IEP, but they're often people that are outside the classroom that can help with ideas. So when our team meets and is like, okay, we have these students that people are concerned about because they failed the rescreen and there's all these concerns, let's assign them to this person as a support coordinator. Now, that person is going to check in with their classroom team weekly. They're going to help them design maybe some systems that that particular student could use. So just kind of trying all the things we can try before we jump to that special education evaluation process.
That makes complete sense. And when we think about families, because we talked about you have the family interview, and sometimes families have some concerns, but there's also times that families only have one child and they don't know child development, right? Like that's not their area of expertise. So sometimes their child will get into the classroom, they'll get settled, and concerns will be brought to the parent. How do you help families that are kind of caught off guard by this, or like, wait, no, my child doesn't have a delay? Like, how do you support them in this process? Because it can be really tricky to navigate. Like, we're not diagnosing them. That's not our job, right? But even just saying something could be wrong with your child can be upsetting to some families. So how do you navigate that?
I think I'm so lucky. This team that works here is just amazing. And so they're very cognizant of those kinds of factors. We know that we have so many different cultures that come into our school, and culturally, people have different feelings about disabilities. And so this team here with our psychologists, our social workers, occupational therapists, they're just really, really skilled people at helping families through that process. And we know that it's not going to happen overnight. And so we try to be gentle and push a little bit, but don't push too far. And for the most part, we found that families, as long as they have some time to be here with us, it's not, you know, one that comes in with 3 months left of the school year, but they get to that point on their own and they kind of figure it out, because we are always inviting them in and they might see all the other students and be like, oh, okay, now I understand what they're saying. Or over time, when they see the progress or the lack of progress in their child, they start to come to that kind of realization. So yeah, this group of people that work in this building is just, they're so kind and gentle, but also professional and know what they're doing. So I'm lucky. I don't feel like I have to do it all.
You don't have to do much at all, right? It sounds like that relationship piece is very important. Like that relationship between the classroom teacher and the support staff and the families is really important to you guys. And I think that's crucial, because people, when they feel safe, will eventually, you know, be able to be open to new ideas. But when they feel defensive or they're scared or they're not understanding the process because it's new to them, they might be harder to discuss it with, because they just don't feel comfortable with you. So that's awesome that you guys spend so much time like cultivating that relationship with the families. And it's something a lot of programs think they're doing, but I think we could always do better at it personally.
Yeah. And we could always do better too.
Yeah. So it's just a hard area.
And it also sounds like as a staff, you have a strong respect for families and knowing that they know their children. And sometimes it might be a hard conversation, but going in with it with that respect of, okay, we do know that you know your child. We know the experiences your child has had. This is what we're seeing from our perspective. Let's have a conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. Beside it being state law, we've always been also people who would offer translators and interpreters for families that need that service. And we are lucky in that we have a family that maybe has a lower incidence language, that comes in and may need some support, we have the University of Illinois right here. And so we can pull from our resources there to try to find help, do interpret, but also have that cultural community background to support.
So it sounds like even when the child's already getting supports, they're really part of that team and that planning for the child's success. So it's just, it's neat to see the family integrated in so seamlessly.
Yeah. I mean, I think that is an intention of this program, this building, the way our building was built. If any of you ever have the opportunity to come visit, it's something that we're really proud of, is that it's made for preschoolers. It's made for families. There's an intentional large lobby for families to gather. In all of our classrooms, there's a big window for observing. So we thought about those things when the building was being designed and built, and continue to use those to keep those types of relationships with our families.
You guys have a really nice library too for family.
Yes, we do.
What resources, besides your amazing library, what resources do you offer families, like in the community or just in general, when they do need support?
We have our See You Early program that is able to help our families it's our prevention initiative group that works with our families from prenatal to 3. And then we often get a lot of those students that transition into pre-K. So that's really helpful. Living in a university town is really such an amazing thing to be able to have access to so many things. So we have things like TAP, the autism program here at the university, that we can help have families go to. Our medical clinics in this area have grown so much, especially in the developmental pediatrics area. It's not 6-month waiting lists anymore like it used to be, because there was only one doctor. There's quite a few. So and I think that's growing. Like we're seeing more and more outside therapy providers that we can refer to. And we always tell families that, you know, you can only do more, like going to multiple therapists, your school therapist and an outside one, is not going to hurt your child. Like that's only going to help them build skills even faster. So we always try to help refer out if we think that that would be something the family would take advantage of and that they would be interested in utilizing.
So when you refer children out, do you work together then with that therapist? Do you have a way of helping the families like sign a release so that you can talk together and coordinate your efforts instead of working in different entities?
Yeah, absolutely. Our speech therapists for sure are excellent at that. It depends on who the other person is, but all of our therapists are trying to get releases signed so that they can communicate back and forth and try to coordinate those goals and objectives that everyone's working on together. Some are easier to do that with than others. You know, it just depends, but we definitely try. So I don't know if I've seen it as much in other with other professionals. So maybe some of the mental health kind of things are a little bit more confidential and private, and they don't necessarily want to share those things. But as far as physical therapy and occupational therapy and speech therapy, I think we've got a pretty good back and forth kind of system going with our local providers.
Yeah, just from personal experience on the mental health side of things, you can choose what they share with the school. And that's, it's kind of nice as the parent being able to control that, because there's some things like, they don't need to know that, it's not their business type of deal. So yeah, when working with children that are working with a mental health specialist, it's nice that they're able to kind of pick and choose what's shared where. So we've gone through the screening and we know, you know, that process, and we've kind of talked about how we let children get settled and we just kind of keep an eye, and that you put a lot of things in place before you get to a referral process. But let's say we've done all that and we're like, okay, nope, we definitely need to refer for an IEP. How does that get started? What does it look like from basically start to finish?
Yeah. So again, I am super lucky with the staff that I have here. We have an assessment team that meets every other week with an agenda of our kids that we're going to talk about, our systems that we're going to talk about. And they are probably the highest functioning team of professionals that I've ever been in place with. Like, it's just, it's really, really well done. And so that includes, so both of our social workers are on that team, our school psychologist and any intern that she may have. We have a speech therapist whose half of her job is dedicated to that team. And then others as needed. So if they have physical therapy needs, we have a physical therapist that's available, occupational therapy as well, a bilingual speech therapist who speaks Spanish. And then occasionally, you know, we have those lower incidence hearing and vision staff members that might need to come into the fray. But in general, we've got a core group of people that works really, really well together. And so what they will usually do is we'll end up talking about these students multiple times during these assessment team meetings as we are going through all those steps you mentioned. And then at some point we'll say, okay, we need to observe. We need you, Trisha, our school psychologist, we need you to go in and observe this child and see what you think. All the other people have been in and out of the classroom probably because that's how our system is created, so that we kind of have core people that work with four different classrooms. But our school psychologist sees everyone. So we just ask her to go in and look and observe and then come back and report to the assessment team the next time. And then if the team talks and feels like, okay, it's time for us to move ahead with an evaluation, we will schedule the domains meeting with the family and the classroom teacher and the appropriate team and get that started. When we have students that are already enrolled in the program that we refer in that way, generally we have a social worker from that assessment team, our school psychologist, and then any of the other associated related service people who might closely work with that classroom do the evaluation. We do a mixture of play-based, standardized, and then observational things. Parent interview is also, so the developmental profile is something that my team uses a lot if they don't feel like they can get a really good picture of the child from observation. They might ask the family to fill that out or ask them questions. We take all those results together, all the associated people write their reports, and then we generally meet again as a team of all those people that would be associated with that evaluation and just kind of go through like, which eligibility criteria do you think this child is going to meet best? And then kind of plan for how the evaluation meeting's going to run, who's going to lead it, what criteria are we going to present to the families? And then what are some possible goals that we might address? And then when you get to that point, the child's already been in the classroom. So they've already been receiving a lot of these things. In some ways, it's almost a formality because of the teacher already having both licensures. So we might put a few extra things in place that we wouldn't have without the IEP, but it's not like any of our kids are missing out on something without having an IEP. Like our team is really, really great at just putting in place something that a kid needs when they need it and not having to wait for that like label or identifier.
Yeah, which is practice.
Yeah. We like to say you don't need a label to provide supports. You don't. So why wait? Just do it if you can.
Exactly.
So this has been quite a process then, from the initial screening to evaluation to the referral. Once an IEP is finally established, how do you plan for support across all environments once that IEP in place? What does that look like with your program?
I don't think that it necessarily has to be just when they're all the things are in place. We do this all the time. So our teams meet weekly. We have weekly team collaborations. And that looks like we have an hour and a half between our AM and PM session. And 45 minutes of that time, or 30 to 45 minutes of that time, each team per week has a set aside collaboration time. And that's when they all sit together, the classroom teacher, including both the teaching assistants, because we feel like they're a big part of our team and we don't want to exclude them from anything because they are also educators. The speech pathologist, and then other social worker, and then other associated people with that, maybe with that classroom, all meet together every week to talk about the students in that classroom, to plan for specific interventions, to check in and see, okay, why haven't they been coming to school? Like, what's going on? All those conversations happen weekly in every single one of my classrooms. So, and yeah, it's very intentional and planned for, and something I think everyone should have the opportunity to do.
I would agree. And you have to be really intentional when you have a team of people. Everybody's got schedules. They're all over the place. You know, if they're not specific with your district, you have to be intentional. But I think it's important. It needs to be prioritized. It's like, no, you cannot miss this. It's not a choice. We have to.
Yes.
And it's wonderful that you have everyone who works with the children in that classroom part of that team meeting, because then it's not just, okay, it's the teachers and teacher assistants and they're trying to figure out, okay, here's what we can do. But then you've got the input of any of the therapists that might be working with that room. You get different perspectives and what everyone sees, so you can best provide the most support needed for the children, whether they have an IEP or not.
Absolutely. Yeah, because just like you said, our teachers and teaching assistants are always talking in their classroom and planning together. They do that all the time. But they have that one really set aside time per week to include all those other people and their expertise to offer other ideas. So,
are families ever invited to those meetings if it pertains to their child, or how does that work? How do you include the families when you're at that point?
We might include the family in some of those discussions. It would be very individualized because most of the time we're trying to talk through several students in that 30 to 45 minutes. So it might not always work out. But if we schedule something in advance and we're like, yes, we really need to talk to this family, we're going to bring them in and ask them to come in at this time. And we'll all be there to offer our perspectives and hear what they have to say. We might do that. Yeah.
We've had a lot of information. You've covered a lot with walking us through all this. Is there anything else that you want to add or any advice you have for people as they get started or they're looking at reorganizing, or just anything you want anybody to know about the referral and screening process, MTSS process? I mean, we've touched on a lot. So any of this.
Yeah. I think some of the things that we've talked about, I just would just reinforce that having that time where teams can really sit down together and plan and talk and work out all those things together that's within the school day, their work day, is really vital and really important. And so trying to find a way to work within whatever system you have, I know it's not always easy, but if you have the opportunity to design that yourself, it is invaluable. Like, I don't think that we would be able to do what we do if we didn't have that specific time set aside. And then the other thing I would say is that I think it's really important to recognize that they're all preschoolers, whether they have a disability or don't. We're here to get them ready for the rest of their school career. And do we have to have a label on something? No, because sometimes those labels will follow those children for the rest of their lives. And that makes me sad personally to think about that. So I think we have to be really careful about labeling and calling them diagnoses and all of those things, because we want to make sure that we're not setting these students up for some failure in the future. We want to set them up for success.
And at the end of the day, they're humans just like us. I think sometimes that gets forgotten when we're dealing with children, but they're just little humans, and they deserve the same decency and respect an adult does. So
absolutely. Yep.
All right. Well, thank you very much for talking with us. It's been fun.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the StarNet Regions 1 and 3 podcast. If you have any questions or concerns, please reach out by emailing starnet@wiu.edu or submit a request by clicking on the Request Services tab on our homepage.